Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition we have here of Crime and Science Radio, of course, hosted by Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called Follow the Money, Catching Cheaters, Frauds, and Con Artists, an interview with security frauds investigator Richard B. York. So without any further ado, let's take it away with our hosts of the show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Welcome, everyone. This show is definitely personal for me because a couple of years ago, some research into my family history brought me into contact with our guest for this episode of Crime and Science Radio, Richard York, whose great-great-grandfather is my great-grandfather. And for those of you who don't have a cousinship chart handy, that makes us second cousins once removed. All that aside, we quickly became friends as well, and I learned that he's been a police officer and later held an important position in law enforcement in the state of Kansas, working as a director of enforcement for the Office of the Kansas Securities Commissioner. And that meant he was investigating fraud and other financial crimes. So, of course, I invited him to be on our show, and happily he accepted. So welcome, Richard.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
Well, welcome to the show, Richard. You had kind of an unusual path to get into law enforcement because you started out as a professional guitarist, teaching guitar playing and all that stuff, which is near and dear to my heart, and I know Jan's too. But tell us about this transition, how you went from rock star to the Arkansas City Police Department.
Okay, it was an interesting transition. I had started playing guitar when I was 7, and by the time I was 12 to 13, I played on a local TV show probably a dozen times. Did recording studio work here in Wichita, a couple of recording studios, and also down in Oklahoma City. And I was also teaching guitar at a music store. I had, I think, upwards of 30-some students, which is quite a bit for 1 week. And the economy basically tanked in Wichita. Wichita is known for its aircraft industry, construction of airplanes. And when a major industry like that goes into the dumps, things like paying for guitar lessons for a child gets set aside, and it doesn't happen, and people don't spend money for entertainment. They're on a tight budget. They're also maybe sometimes moving out of the community. And so feeling that crunch, and I had some opportunities to, one of them was to play in a show band down in a Caribbean island, and that scared me to death to be, I'm kind of a homeboy, so it scared me to death to be away that much. So I started looking at some other things that caught my interest, and law enforcement was one of them. And I had a cousin locally who was on the police department. I spoke to him and decided that things were kind of gelling at the same time. I had a best friend who was killed in California, and I thought, you know, I can't do anything about that, but maybe I can help people. And law enforcement seemed to be a very fascinating career. So I ended up going down to I was from Wichita at the time, but I went down to Arkansas City, Kansas. It's a border town to Oklahoma, to take the police science courses that they had at the community college. I already had one degree in music theory, and I thought, well, what's the difference? I'll just get another degree and go from there. And so I shifted into police science and got then familiar with the local police department, sheriff department staffing, rode hundreds of hours with local officers, and I was hired on the police department as a patrolman. And from that point, my career kind of took off. I was there 13 and a half years and worked my way through the ranks from patrolman to corporal to sergeant to administrative lieutenant. And things it seems like it happened fast, but, you know, 13 and a half years for that was probably about normal. And I enjoyed that very much.
Well, our listeners may not know that Arkansas, is that how you pronounce it? Arkansas City is in Kansas and not in the state of Arkansas. Which
that is correct.
It's even pronounced differently, but spelled the same. Now, it's not a very big city. I understand it's about 12,000 people. So it's a smaller community. How big was the police force there, and what exactly were your duties while you were there? What kind of things were you involved in?
Sure. The police force consisted of approximately 32 to 34 total staff. That would include dispatchers, patrol officers, support staff that would be there. We ended up with the ambulance service at the police department. It's an unusual combination, but what happened is the local funeral homes that was handling it at the time got fed up with the criticisms that they were taking, and probably rightfully so, and they finally decided they had enough of it, and there was an ambulance that they owned, and they took it to the police department, parked it up front, went in and tossed the keys on the desk and said, "It's yours." Well, the police chief and the city manager said, "Well, let's make this work, and since police officers are on duty 24/7, I think it'll work out." You know, that was their theory, and in the course of doing that, then they required the police officers to take advanced medical training, and I was an EMT. Almost all of the police officers were EMTs. A few years down the road, we decided that some of the staff needed to be even more technically skilled, so we hired a couple of paramedics to go along with us with the ambulance service too, and so they provided an even higher level of performance over and above EMT. But, you know, while I was there, I was on well over 1,000 ambulance calls, and you know, that includes homicide scenes where people are killed, and fatalities, you know, from traffic accidents, suicides, you know, stillborn, anything you can imagine came across this. So I was an EMT and went on those calls as well. I will say that throws an interesting perspective to the community when you are the one that's injured and the person that's taking care of you is carrying a .357 or a .44 Magnum and handcuffs and mace, but that is the caregiver. And, you know, you would think they would be terrified, but the community loved us. You know, we had a wonderful relationship with the community. There were still things that were, you know, tragic things that would happen, but the relationship was good.
So you might show up to not only help the victims medically and the transportation there, but you would also be involved in investigating if there was a crime or associated with the incident?
Yes.
You'd be doing both. That's
so,
very unusual.
So wearing two hats.
Yeah.
And you know, at the same time that a suspect who may have been injured trying to escape maybe in an automobile and crash the car, something like that, while you're rendering aid to them, you might be also reading them the Miranda warning. So now, tell me where can that happen at?
So while you're counting 60, you're also saying book him down.
Yes.
Yes. And sometimes there were some pet phrases that we would use, yes.
Well, in addition to the on-the-job training you received there, you also took some courses at Wichita State University. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. I already had an associate's degree in police science from the local community college, but I decided I wanted to further my degree, so I enrolled at Wichita State University in the Administration of Justice program. Well, mostly, I mean, I had to be a part-time student because I was working, well, initially I worked 6 days a week. That was the mm-hmm. requirement. Later on it changed to 5 days a week. So I took a lot of night classes at WSU. I commuted back and forth. It's basically an hour and a half drive each way. And I did that for 5 years until I got my bachelor's degree. I had a lot of hours in college. And I think when I graduated, I had about 165 hours. Normally, only need about 120. And I had dual majors, a major in police administration and also criminal investigation. And I had a minor in music and a minor in mathematics. So I was a little bit of the oddball, I guess. See, I wanted to mention one thing about these commutes, because when I would go to night classes, a lot of times these classes aren't out until 10 o'clock at night, and then I have an hour and a half drive to go home. And after a long day of work, sometimes that was hard to do. Mm. And part of the trip going back home was on a narrow two-lane road. There's no shoulder to it, and it's got several curves to it. And in order to stay awake, I would listen to Inner Sanctum on the radio. And I don't know whether you remember that radio show, but
I do.
I'm telling you what, it could be really scary if you were sitting in the dark or you were traveling alone. But that kept me awake, kept me from going off the road, and I got home safely every time.
And so tell us how you came to move from working in a small city's police department to being in a state security commissioner's office.
Okay, sure. What happened, I had already received my bachelor's degree, and I was the administrative lieutenant for the police department. And when I say that, I still had all police duties. I would go out on all kinds of calls. But I also wrote the test for promotion, the applicant's test, the interviews. I was the EEO officer. And I carried several different hats, and all of that while being an EMT as well. But I saw a classified ad in one of the Sunday papers looking for the Kansas Securities Commissioner's office. And I'm going to, probably for purposes of this interview, just abbreviate to KSC. KSC means Kansas Securities Commission. And they were seeking investigators. And when I read the requirements, they required a minimum of a bachelor's degree, 5 years of investigative experience as a certified law enforcement officer, and ability to travel. And so I went and it wasn't online. I think I called and I got the full description and applied for. They were hiring two people in Wichita, which was going to be a brand new office, and they were hiring one person for the Topeka office. And I applied. I think there was over 125 applicants, and I was hired as one of the special investigators for Wichita, and my wife and I moved from Arkansas City to Wichita.
Now, you have some other educational and other certifications other than, you know, being an EMT and being a police officer. What other hats do you have in your hat rack?
And a guitarist. You left that one.
Yeah, a guitarist.
I could see after getting into this job that with investigations that there was a couple of certifications that were applicable. One was a certified fraud examiner, and I was an associate of that. And certified fraud examiners are actually pretty well known for that expertise. It was a certified fraud examiner that actually repeatedly tried to alert the SEC to the Bernie Madoff scam that was going on. And so a lot of times when a business has a suspected fraud, but they don't know how to piece it together, they will hire a certified fraud examiner to do that. So that was one shingle that I had, I guess. The other shingle was I saw that there was a lot of overlap of securities investigations with federal law, and hence the other organization is called ACAMS, Association of Certified Money Laundering Specialists. And I'll just abbreviate that as ACAMS. And ACAMS deals more with financial institutions such as banks, credit unions, casinos. Every financial institution in the United States has to file suspicious activity reports, even car dealerships, jewelry stores, grocery stores. If they do any type of wire transfers or money orders, loans, suspicious activity reports are to be filed promptly, and then they go into a central repository, and the U.S. Attorney's Office in every state is required to have a team set up that reviews SAR reports that have been submitted. And I happen to be on the SAR review team for the Wichita area, working with IRS Criminal Division, Postal Inspection Service, FBI, Secret Service, a myriad of police department investigators and sheriff investigators. And I was on the team. Every month I would review approximately 500 suspicious activity report forms to see if there's something that fell into our bailiwick of investment fraud. And so these certifications that I'm talking about kind of help me to better do my job as an investigator and also as an administrator.
Well, you know, you've in answering that, you've used a lot of terms here, and I'm not sure
yes.
we'll be dealing with the vocabulary of financial crimes is not something that people hear them on the news all day, but I'm not sure they really have an understanding for what the definitions of these things are. So can you tell us a little bit about security and fraud and money laundering and Ponzi schemes and insider trading? What are these things in, like, generic terms?
Okay. And I'll try and kind of summarize those so that they make sense from a layman's perspective. What is a security? That's probably the ground point that we're start at. Securities are basically intangible investments. In other words, that's something that you cannot really see it working, but it works. Stocks, bonds, debentures. Kansas, when I was hired, I was primarily hired to investigate oil and gas investments, and that investment form was fractional interest in oil and gas ventures. So if a tanker load of oil was being sold, then an investor would get maybe a 32nd of the profit from that. And, of course, expenses had to be deducted with that, too. There's actually about 13 to 15 terms that fall under security, and any one of those is deemed by the courts to be a security. The most interesting term we ever had was called investment contract. And I actually had some suspects who would be foolish enough to title their agreement with the investor investment contract. And so we didn't have to prove that it was a stock or a bond or anything. It says right there what it is. And the courts have gone on to define what investment contracts are. It's called a four-prong test. But basically it's an investment of money into a common enterprise for the purpose of making a profit through the managerial efforts of another person. And what all of that means, that gobbledygook means, is you're going to put your money up and you're going to be passive. Someone else is going to take care of it and make money for you and for them and for all the other investors. So as long as you have the perspective in your mind, I don't have to do anything other than to send my money in, you're going to be an investor and you're going to be covered somehow under state securities laws, which are also known as blue sky laws. And every state in the United States is required to have a securities commissioner, securities staff, securities laws, and have a means of enforcing those laws. Just to take this one step further, Kansas, the land of Oz, was the first state to pass securities laws, and that was in 1911. The language that was written there was so meaningful that all other states patterned after Kansas and wrote their laws to be identical to what Kansas used. And then that was 1911. And it wasn't until 1933 that the federal securities laws came into place and the anti-fraud statutes were also patterned after Kansas language. So Kansas... yeah, it's the land of Oz, but it's famous for its securities laws and for securities enforcement.
Hmm. Well, now, I may be mistaken, but was that 1911 law, was that in connection with the oil and gas investment fraud?
No, actually back then, the frauds that were going on had to do with railroad stocks. And Kansas, you know, basically is a was a farm and agricultural community, and so many of our agricultural people were persuaded into buying stocks in railroad investments, and some of those were just completely bogus, and others, there just was no foundation to, they were maybe so far in debt that there was no way of making profit. So hence the securities laws came on to not only have the statutes for what is fraudulent and how to prosecute that, but what they have to reveal. And in securities, you have to reveal the good, the bad, and the ugly. It's called full disclosure. And federal securities laws and state securities laws are all premised under full disclosure. And there's, in today's world, and I'm talking about 2016, it's been this way for probably, I don't know, maybe 20 years. There's three cops on the block that help to police the securities industry. There's the state securities, which I was a member of, the United Securities and Exchange Commission, and that's, of course, a federal agency, and then there's another one called FINRA, Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. The state basically was designed under the State Securities Commission to investigate more of the private offerings, I'm going to say, to a certain extent, smaller investment schemes. Now, small is a relative term when you get into this, because one of them that we handled was $80 million. Mm. And so, you know, but I've handled investments as small as $1,000. The Securities and Exchange is mostly the cop on the block that will handle stuff that is registered and traded stocks, mutual funds, hedge funds, those types of things that are registered. They're big offerings, and they're registered with the SEC. FINRA is an independent auditing association. They provide a lot of investor advice, but they also, it's a self-regulatory organization, and they do audits of brokerage firms, investment advisors, etc. And so there's three of us that are out there working. We're not working in competition with one another. We're handling the segments that we're best suited to do. And so it's a pretty broad spectrum.
That is all kinds of things. Well, I know from talking to you, you have a lot of different kinds of investigations and investment schemes, that I'll just call them that,
yes.
That people have come up with. Some of them actually really creative. But let's talk with something that might not look as suspicious to an investor. So tell us about oil and gas investments. I think we had talked a little bit at one
sure.
time about that. So, yeah.
Yes, and I was hired with the agency, with KSC, in 1984, and more than 90% of the investigations that were ongoing were oil and gas related. That was happening at a time when the oil and gas industry was at a boom. There was a lot of drilling going on, a lot of exploration, a lot of companies forming to get into that business. And so typically in the homeland, and I'll have to say this too, is the premier state for oil and gas production was Texas. Oklahoma was next, Kansas was next, and probably Pennsylvania was in there, maybe at fourth place. So there was a lot of oil exploration going on in the state of Kansas, and hence there was a lot of fraud. We had people that had previously worked for an oil company, and they decided, hey, I don't know why I need to get my hands all dirty out here slinging this oil around and drilling and handling the pipe and working all hours. And I can just form my own company, and I'll take investors in, and I'll have somebody else do all this work. So we had a lot of oil operators that touted their investments popping up. And so 90% of the cases, and when I started, I think as soon as I was done with training, I believe I had 21 cases, and probably 19 out of the 21 were oil and gas cases.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a lot. And in the oil industry, there is a lot of ways to be able to fraud investors. And so we had to get – an investigator has to be willing to self-train and also receive in-house training so that they understand the terminology of whatever case they're assigned. In this matter, we're talking about oil industry. So we set up classes with petroleum geologists to tell us how things work, with drilling companies to tell us how things work. So we learned the right side of the industry so that we would be able to recognize the wrong side when somebody was doing something wrong. And bringing that back, that oil and gas investment, let's say it's a 30-second interest in a well to be drilled, each investor may be putting in $10,000. And then once the well is drilled, if it's a dry hole, state law requires that it be properly plugged. So they may actually have to cough up some money to close out this investment besides the $10,000. But if it went into production, then they're supposed to get a 1/32nd share of whatever revenue is made from selling the oil. And oil companies were somewhat unscrupulous in saying, well, wait, I'll just move that tank of oil. I've got a pump truck. I'll just move that oil to this other lease, and I own, and the oil company owns 100% of it. And so there were some things that were happening at nighttime that involved the theft of oil product, or sometimes they would just falsify records. One way of doing that is investors also have to pay the expenses that's going on. So Joe Blow, that has 10 different wells out here, and let's say I'm on in well number one, I get billed for the expenses for treating the oil and picking it up and other things that they may do. And in this day and age, you hear a lot about fracking, fracturing the subsurface area so they can produce more. But what might happen is the guy that owns the company transfers the liabilities for his own leases to the investors in a lease that's not going to pay the investors. And mm-hmm. so they end up paying the bill for somebody else. So, you know, it's not just a matter of making money, it's making money in a fair manner. I remember the supervisor that I had when I first started, and I remember somebody calling in from out of state and talking to him, complaining about this operator. And he said, you know, let me tell you something. If you are so far away that you can't come down and look at the well and see the pump jack going up and down and talk to the farmer who has the tanks and know how frequently those trucks are coming to pump the oil off, then you're too far away. But invariably, we would have people from all over the United States investing in oil and gas leases in Kansas. And likewise, some of our Kansas people invest in oil leases in Oklahoma and Texas. So it was a complicated deal we had to get trained on to understand how the schemes could work. Have I confused you?
No. I'm just thinking, you know, as you're talking, of course, what becomes obvious is, you know, just what you had said earlier, is that for each of these areas, and I know you didn't just investigate oil and gas, I want to talk to you about some of the range of things you had come your way, but you really had to become an expert at some level with each of these areas to be able to figure out what smelled off.
Yeah.
About it, right?
That's correct. And, you know, after the oil and gas boom of the mid-80s, back, that probably fizzled out maybe about 1990, and we were seeing very few cases coming in then about oil and gas. things shifted. We had a tremendous number of mining cases that then flared up. Gold mine, silver mines, platinum, even coal. We did a search warrant in Little Rock, Arkansas, of offices that were selling interest in a coal mine. And it turned out to be a fraud. And I think there was four or five of us that went over there to execute the search warrant of the office and take the records. But they were selling rights to to mine coal underneath a city. They had the mineral rights, but you can't do that for safety reasons. And so they knew they couldn't do that, but yet nobody had acquired those mineral rights underneath the city. And, I mean, you could just imagine if there was caverns and stuff under the city, pretty soon the whole thing could collapse. And so what collapsed was we found out what was going on and did a search warrant and then charged. I think there was two people that were ramrodding that thing. But they had a pretty significant sales office. Now, I'm going to bring you into another term that's typical in the securities industry, and that's called a boiler room. A boiler room is a sales office that sells whatever the security is going to be called. And it may have been fractional interest in a mining operation, or it might have been fractional interest in an oil and gas venture. And boiler rooms tended to be in some pretty major areas. Los Angeles was always a hub, Salt Lake City, down around Florida, around the Disney properties, ironically. But this particular boiler room was actually in Little Rock, Arkansas. And the people that were selling it were just people off the street that were having fun doing it. And they were told to make up a name. And so they would use some TV star's first name, and then they would use another TV star's last name. And so when we went into the office and did the search warrant, then we got the payroll records and found out that, you know, Miss Starlet was actually Lucy something or other, you know. And so we were able to quickly match them up. And the other thing we'd do with the salespeople is we would grant a certain number of them immunity from criminal prosecution if they snitched out the people at the top. And let me tell you, they line up. If they think they can get immunity, they line up at the door so they can talk to the regulators and make those kind of deals, because they knew the consequences was a felony charge against them. And in the securities world, selling an unregistered security is a felony. Securities fraud is a felony. But which one sounds more palatable if you're going to be charged with something? You want to be charged with something, well, I just didn't know what I was doing, and I got involved with that. Yeah, you lied. You know, you lied to the investors. But we were always able to find people who were easy, you know, wanting to take the easy road out of responsibility, and then we'd use them to testify against the top dogs. That was the goal, is to take them down. KSC had several tools to be able to work with. It was a fascinating, I was in the law enforcement side of it, and as law enforcement officers, you know, when I was on the street in our Kansas City, and you have a crime, basically you have two options. You either arrest or you don't arrest. The reason you wouldn't arrest is you're not sure you have enough evidence to make the charge hold. So you wait, and hopefully you can get more statements, maybe another witness, maybe you can get some laboratory evidence to make that crime complete so that a jury will understand it. When I went to work for the Securities Commission, I found out, oh man, they've got some more bullets in their guns that don't exist in the law enforcement community. Yes, we carry guns. And when I came to work and I went through training, one of our staff attorneys said to each of us, there was four of us going through the training at the same time, said that 1 in 10 of the cases that you're assigned to is going to involve a felon who is committing securities fraud. Hence, because of that, your safety is in jeopardy, and you need to be armed, and you need to be aware that some of these people can be dangerous. And we've had people doing security scams that were convicted of murder. You wouldn't think that would happen, but it does. Well, by the time I left and retired, over 25% of the cases involved felonies. So it wasn't getting better, it was getting worse. Now, I was talking about some of the tools that we have. I can't remember saying that carrying a gun ever helped me solve a crime in the securities world. But the tool that helped me immensely was we could issue subpoenas, just like a district court could do. I would write the subpoena. I would, at that point in time, we were a lot of times either faxing it or emailing it to our Topeka office where the attorneys were our staff attorneys were located. And these were prosecutors, criminal prosecutors. They would review it and say, yep, that's appropriate. Or they might say, take this one. You're asking for one thing here. I don't think. The thing they usually kicked on is if I asked for medical records. and that was about the time that HIPAA was coming into play. And they'd say, I don't think you need to know the medical records at this point in time. And go, no, only if they become fugitive. So I would back off and leave that out. But with the subpoena, what we would do is we would find out where an investor's check was deposited, because back in the good old days, checks were actually being returned. The original checks were being returned to the account holder. And so you could look at the front and the back of the check. So as times move forward, pretty soon the banks are going, no, we don't want to have to handle all those checks and return all those, and the customers don't need them. They can simply ask for them. So the bank simply had imaged copies of the checks. You know, for us in early days, I was used to collecting evidence because I would sometimes use my fingerprint powder and dust them and try and get prints. But the reality is it's got the victim's prints on it. It's got the suspect's prints on it. It's maybe got a couple people at the bank. The victim probably passed it off to their spouse. And so you may end up with five or six different people's prints on it. Fingerprints didn't make a bit of difference, because we didn't really need to know who touched the check. We needed to know where the money went. So we would issue the back of the check would tell us the bank, and it would have a about an 11-digit code that the bank was required to have on the back, and usually there'd be some type of endorsement. So we would see if the check went into the account that was personal or if it went into a business account, and we would subpoena the banking records. Which would be the monthly statements from the suspect. Now, I'm talking about the suspect's account. We would ask for the monthly statements. We would ask for the signature card, the photo ID that they filed when they opened up the account, and normally that's a driver's license photo. Okay, so when we get that, now we've got their date of birth, their social security number, which is required on a bank account too. We would have their address. We would have the title for what they were in the business organization. And then, after we had the monthly statements, we'd go, wait, this investor issued a check for $10,000, but look on this. And we would get maybe a year of monthly statements, and we'd see, there's 40. There's 40 checks that's over $10,000 each coming into this account. So we would then get copies of the front and the back of each one of those checks. We would identify who the other investors are, call them on the phone. A lot of them are out of state. Although I traveled 14 different states on investigations, they didn't like to send me out of state just on a single investor. It had to be pretty serious for me to do that kind of travel. But I would be the bearer of bad news to an investor who may be in Long Beach, California, and say, my name is Richard York. I'm a special investigator with the Kansas Securities Commissioner's Office, and we're investigating the ABC Oil Company in Kansas, and you issued check number 2561 on such and such a date, payable to, and in the memo section it says for an investment. And these people would be shocked. Sometimes they just plain didn't believe me and didn't want to talk. And I would have to write them a letter on letterhead and say, I just called you, and the letter would say, here is my title, and call my office, or I would set up a date to call them back, because I'm the bearer of bad news. They didn't know that their investment was in a fraudulent enterprise and their money is gone. Now, I mentioned bank subpoenas, but see, we could issue the subpoenas to any entity, an individual, maybe it might be somebody who worked there, and we would call that individual in to testify, and we could compel testimony, just like a grand jury would do. So those are some remarkable powers that the regular police officer does not have to do these investigations. But the state legislature felt that our agency needed to have these powers so that we could fulfill the mission of the office and help safeguard investments and help prosecute investments. So by far and large, the best investigative tool we had was the subpoena.
Well, as a police officer, I mean, when you get called to a crime scene, you know, usually someone is injured, or there's a domestic violence thing, or there's a car, or there's something going on. As a financial crimes investigator, how do these things come on your radar in the first place? Who actually comes to you and says, "Hey, I got an issue"?
Yes, sometimes it's an investor who's tried to cash out of an investment and get their money back, and they just get put off and put off and put off. So sometimes the call actually gets directed to us from an investor. At other times, the investor doesn't know what to do, and they go and talk to the local police department, sheriff department, county or district attorney. And those people, I traveled the state training law enforcement and district and county attorneys to let them know what our office would do. And so they would typically say, "Hey, I'm not going to investigate that, but I know Mr. York, and I've got his business card here, and this is the person you need to call." So sometimes the referral came from law enforcement. Sometimes it came from a tax preparer. At this time of year, people are trying to do their taxes. They've got to get their 1099s lined up, and they know they should be receiving one from this investment, and it hasn't come, and it hasn't come, and it hasn't come. So the tax preparer may be the person who's really suspicious about it because documentation is not adding up. It may be an attorney that the person has gone to see, and the attorney, the private attorney, says, "Whoa, this just does not smell right. Let me call Mr. York's office." And because I also gave lectures to the law community, I lectured to attorneys. We quickly found out that the investigators knew more about securities law than about 70 or 80% of the attorneys. And that's because in law school, securities law is a specialized area, just like patent law would be. And you have to elect to get in that area. And so most newbie attorneys, they didn't have any intention of practicing that area, so they skipped that. And so, as it turns out, we knew more about securities law than the average attorney, which is a scary thing.
Well, you know, you work for the state of Kansas, but, I mean, what if the investor, you mentioned earlier about Los Angeles, the investor who is involved in this investigation is out of state, or the company itself is out of state? What are the jurisdictional and legal hoops you have to jump through to cross state lines for these investigations?
Yes. Again, very different than traditional law enforcement, because in law enforcement you have the crime scene, and that's going to be in maybe a municipality, in a certain county, in a certain state. Well, for us, the company that's operating the fraud might be a Kansas company, but the bulk of the investors may be out of state. We have authority because the company operated in the state of Kansas. To flip that around, let's say the company was in California, but we've got investors in Kansas. We still have the authority to investigate and prosecute based on our investors. Now, you have to put that in a practical sense. If we've only got one investor in Kansas and the company's in California and California has 100 investors, probably what we will do is call our counterparts in California and say, "Here's what we've got. This should be investigated. It appears to be more appropriate for you to prosecute than us. tell us what you're going to do. And if they said they would investigate, then we basically would transfer our information. If they said, we just are snowed under, we can't do that, we would prosecute based on our single investor, and we would drag the people back under arrest warrants from California to face charges in Kansas. So there's actually a third prong, but it's the weakest, and that is, let's say the investor's out of state, the company's out of state, but the bank account is in Kansas. We could actually prosecute because the bank account was here. That is by far the worst choice for us, because now we're bringing in witnesses and suspects, and the costs of doing that are pretty extraordinary. So, like I say, every state has a securities commission, and we would basically try and do our best to help the other state get their investigation online and the prosecution lined up. So it's a matter of cooperation.
Well, I know we have many, many areas and sub-areas we can get into, but with the time we have left, I know that our listeners love war stories. So I'm wondering if you can just tell us about, I know you've handled a really wide variety of cases. If you can just tell us about a couple of the more memorable ones.
Okay. The first way to get in a violation of the securities law is basically by paying a sales commission to somebody who's not a registered sales agent, like a stockbroker, or to run an advertisement. So our office, in our office here in Wichita, I was reading like 6 or 7 rural newspapers for classified ads. Here's an ad. Investors wanted to restart established helicopter company, minimum investment, $3,000, free helicopter rides and flight training for investors. And then the guy actually gave his name, his real name, which is really ironic. And since he printed it, I'm going to give it. Usually I wouldn't. His name was Ken Turner, and he gave a phone number. So one of the tools we use to investigate is we record all phone calls. In Kansas, you only have to be a party to the conversation to be able to record it without any announcement. Now, some states, that varies. I think California may not be that way. Nevada, I know Nevada is not that way. But in Kansas, if I was part of the conversation, I could record it. I wouldn't have to disclose anything at all. So I'd call up, and also we were provided with undercover identification, false identification, a false P.O. box. We had cars that were not noticeable. They didn't look like police cars at all. And the tags on them didn't have, you know, state of Kansas tags. They just had regular tags on them. So we were fully equipped to be able to operate undercover. I called this guy, and he told me that he had a helicopter, but it needed some repairs. And I said, well, is there some kind of agreement? He said, yeah, I'll write up an agreement. And let me call you back. I've got something going on here, and let me find out where you're at. And so I waited, and what I did is I called my contact at the phone company, and I said, can you tell me where this number is? Because when I would do it, we had some software where we could do cross-checks. It's like a Google search now, but in the early days, that wasn't available to the public. And when I talked to my contact at the phone company, he said, Richard, this is a payphone at the bottom of the escalator in Town East Shopping Mall. And I go, really? And so I drove out there, and sure enough, this guy had a kiosk set up so that he blocked off the payphone, and nobody else knew that it was there. And he was having investors call that number. So knowing what that was, myself and another investigator went out there, and of course I've got undercover ID and everything. And I called him and I said, I want to come out, and I've got my checkbook with me. If I'm interested, I'll write you a check. And so I went out, and he gave me the spiel, and he had an investment agreement right there. And I said, am I your first investor? And he goes, yeah. And I said, well, I got some bad news for you. And then I take out my badge and I badge him. and I mean, he just about fell to the floor. And you know, in a deal like that, we have somebody who's probably pulling something that they don't really understand the parameters, and just the advertisement alone meant that he was violating the registration provisions and he was committing a felony by doing the advertising alone. And so I kind of had to educate him and on this, and I simply got an affidavit from him that he was not going to take any money. And now, in the meantime, I had called where he was from and talked to the sheriff's department where he was at. He had no prior criminal history. The sheriff says, oh, yeah, I've seen the helicopter. He crashed it. He said it's probably got $50,000 worth of damage. And so it wasn't a minor repair to the helicopter. It was a major, major deal. But we stopped it. You know, that's part of the goal, is stop these things, move on to the more serious ones. So I got him shut down. And before I was over with, he said, how did you find out I was here? And I go, we can work magic. And I said, don't ever advertise for investors. And so I walked off, you know, with him kind of shaking his head, wondering, how did this happen? I mentioned one of the a very early on case that we had back when I started. My boss actually handled this. Larry Cook was the director of enforcement at that time. And there was a case that we commonly call Culture Farms. And it was an $80 million Ponzi scheme. It's actually a pyramid scheme. And there was 27,000 investors. $80 million, 27,000 investors. Now, this case was so big that it was really not too practical for our office to prosecute it because we simply didn't have the financial means to do it. But joined forces with the Postal Inspection Service out of Kansas City, and my boss and a postal inspector, they basically ran with this thing. And I think there was 13 people that ended up being charged criminally over that. And what, just in a nutshell, what happened, people were persuaded that they could make lots and lots of money if they buy this kit that had some type of a culture in it and grow it in their refrigerator for 2 weeks. It was simply mold. You had to buy 10 packets, cost $350. You'd grow it for 2 weeks. You'd let it sit out for 2 weeks. You'd ship it in, and then purportedly it would be processed for Cleopatra's Cosmetics, for a special cosmetic line. There was five different companies affiliated with this scheme, and it was all just a complete money scheme, and there was no product being sold. The cultures were simply, once you sent them in, they were simply ground up to make more growing kits. So there was a lot of people. And one of the companies was actually located in Lawrence, Kansas. So that's what kind of gave us an interest in furthering. But, you know, that's a huge deal. Had a case that involved a convicted felon, and he was out in a little town in western Kansas that manufactured pumps. And this guy claimed he was just a local, kind of a bum in a way, claimed that he had the inside lead on this company and this new pump that they were going to manufacture, and he was selling stock. And it was a little town, and he basically went and talked to every business person that was there. People were putting in $500, $1,000. He didn't raise a lot of money. And every time they'd write him a check, people said, oh, yeah, he went right over to the bank, and he said he was going to take the money to the bank and deposit it. Well, the reality was his first name was Harvey. He was a convicted felon. He had done an embezzlement in Colorado. He was out on parole. And he simply opened a bank account in his own name. And he opened it in the name of a particular pump company, which he told them the investors to write their check to. And he deposited the money in the account. And then he used the money. He would simply withdraw the money daily on a cash basis, go down to the bar and buy people drinks, sell the deal, brag about how much money he was making. Well, he was spending their own money. The funny thing about this guy, and it was a local undersheriff that called me to report it, and I said, oh, absolutely, this sounds like a fraud. I'll be out there tomorrow. And I went out, and we found where Harvey was at. The sheriff took me to a little town hall where he unlocked it, and we had some privacy. sat down with this guy, and the first words out of his mouth, he crossed his arms and kicked back, first words were, "What took you so long?" And I said, "Harvey, you mean to find out that this was a fraud or to just get in town?" And he said, "Both." And I said, "Well, Harvey, I just found out about yesterday, and for us, that's a world's record on speed." And we arrested him and prosecuted him, and of course, he went back to prison. So, but had an Angora goat farm where the guy advertised for investors, and claimed that, and the advertisement said that you can make a 50% return in 1 year, pretty high investment, and so. I called him, tape recorded it. Myself and one of my investigators went out there. It was in eastern Kansas in the Flint Hills area, and I talked to the guy. And we're out there surrounded by hundreds and hundreds of Angora goats. And my coworker, we were off to the side, just the two of us. And he says, "Richard, how are you going to get us out of this deal?" Because we're thinking, we rode back into the pasture with this guy in his truck. What if he drove off and left us? So I said, "Well, I'm not going to badge him here." And so I turned around to the guy, and I said, "Okay, I'm sold. Where do I go to sign the paperwork?" "Okay, let's go back to the house." So we went back to the house, and that's when we both badged him. And he said, "Well, I don't care if you're cops. You can still invest in this deal." He didn't get it. After we badged him, he still thought we were there for the investment. And so I kind of had to do an education with him. The reason I mentioned that particular case is I was doing a lecture to law enforcement people, and I gave that example, and two of the guys on the second row just started laughing and laughing. They were laughing before I got to the punchline. And after the meeting was over, they came over to me and introduced them to me, and they were IRS criminal investigators. And they said, "We pitched that guy too." And he said, "I can't deal with you folks. I've been hammered by the Securities Commission people. Get out of here." So we scared this guy enough that, you know, he wouldn't even talk to anybody else. So
well,
you have to use the tools to stop the deal. That's the bottom line.
We are unfortunately out of time.
Yes,
and the future, we'll have to try again and talk with you more about the personalities and and some of the other ins and outs of all this. But thank you very much, Richard.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. It's been great.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
And the rest of you, don't invest in Angora goats. Until next time.
Until next time.